Not very often in Northwest history has a flood wiped an entire city off the map. There's a mosaic here in remembrance at what is now the Delta Park light rail stop in North Portland. This used to be Vanport City, Oregon, until the swollen Columbia River burst through a dike. 15 people drowned, and another 18,000 more were made homeless. That catastrophic spring flood has never been repeated, and there's a good reason why.
That flood, that event, led directly to the completion of the negotiation of the Columbia River Treaty.
U.S. Army Corps of Engineers project manager Matt Ray says under the treaty, Canada built three crucial dams way upriver on the Columbia. The U.S. added a fourth on a tributary in Montana. The 1961 treaty requires Canada to store water for downstream flood control.
The Columbia River Treaty and the storage in Canada that was provided by the treaty has been very, very successful in reducing flood damages downstream. The United States got a very good deal for that.
The treaty also directs Canada to assure steady downriver power generation by strategically holding and releasing water. The bargain entitles Canada to a big share of that increased electricity production from American dams. But these days, the amount of wealth transferred north is coming under scrutiny, according to Nancy Steffen of the Bonneville Power Administration.
We have a lot of obligations right now in terms of the river. It's not just power and flood control anymore. And given the world we live in now, I think the entitlement is based on something historically, and that's not the way we operate at this point, so we want to take a good look at it because we think it's probably more than it should be.
In fact, several public utility districts with dams on the Mid-Columbia want the U.S. to give notice to terminate the treaty. Tim Culbertson manages Grant County PUD in central Washington. Culbertson estimates his utility alone contributed $50 million worth of energy last year for transfer to Canada.
Oh, it'd make a huge difference if we were able to keep that at home. That would provide a lot of money for the extensive capital infrastructure that we're rebuilding, and it likely would alleviate a fair amount of rate pressure for our customers.
Culbertson is waiting for more analysis from federal agencies to learn if it's realistic to back out of the treaty. He wonders what the Canadians would do then.
You have to analyze and say, can or would the Canadians operate their reservoirs so differently to cause significant detrimental impact to the downstream projects?
Canada, through the province of British Columbia, has not revealed a bargaining stance. The treaty requires either country to give 10 years' notice to unilaterally back out. So what's happening right now is the many people with an interest in the river are strategizing and positioning ahead of the first window to give notice. That's in 2014. As part of that, Indian tribes on both sides of the border have united in a push to add ecological considerations to any treaty revisions. In Portland, Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission Director Paul Lumley says the original treaty has no provisions for salmon.
One of our great frustrations is that when the treaty was signed in the 60s, the tribes were not considered at all. Well, it's different now.
Leaders of all stripes in the Columbia Basin aim to submit recommendations to the U.S. State Department by the year 2013. Ultimately, it's the State Department's job to negotiate international treaties. In this case, the outcome will determine how the Columbia River runs for decades to come. I'm Tom Bonsi in Portland.